Thank you all. Please be seated. Well, good morning and welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court sitting here at BYU-Idaho on November 7, 2024 for our third and final case of the day. This matter is entitled Gray versus the Idaho Department of Juvenile Corrections, number 50935. That case is brought on appeal by Jeffrey and Michelle Gray, represented by Arthur P. Hart. The respondents are several, but Kelly Beecham, PA-C, is represented by Kathy R. Silak, and the respondents, Idaho Department of Juvenile Correction, Deborah Flitton, Lori Fulmer, Arthur Green, Shalane Kress, and Teresa Patterson are represented by Stevie G. Brown. Please note that in this matter, Justice Long, who's been absent the earlier two cases we've heard here today and excused, is not able to sit in this case and has been recused. And for that reason, we have District Judge Darren Simpson from Blackfoot, who is sitting by designation as a pro tem justice in this case, and he will fully participate in all matters in that regard. Counsel, do any of you have anything preliminary for us before you begin your arguments?
No, Your Honor.
Very well then, Mr. Hart, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, honorable judges, may it please the court.
Mr. Hart?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt right off the bat. I can already tell that I can't hear you very well. If you wouldn't mind speaking up, thank you.
Let me try to get the microphone right. I do have a quiet voice, so. The issues between this court are threefold. Number one, whether or not the district court erred in its failure to apply 28 U.S.C. 1367D and tolling the statute of limitations pertinent to the appellant's claims. And number two, whether or not the district court erred in its failure to apply Idaho Code Section 5-234 and tolling the statute of limitations pertinent to appellant's claims. And three, whether or not the district court abused its discretion in awarding appellees their attorney's fees. Starting with Section 1367D, the very reason Congress enacted 1367D was to ensure that state law claims in federal court would not be time barred when the federal courts dismissed them or dismissed the federal hook that kept the claims there under supplemental jurisdiction. The Supreme Court in Jinks v. Richland, noted that prior to 1367, plaintiffs with these state law and federal claims had very unattractive options. And they were at risk of their claims being time barred during the pendency of the federal action. So Congress passed 1367D to eliminate those risks and ensure that plaintiffs and their state law claims would be preserved while pending in federal court. So as the court in Jinks made clear, Congress intended 1367D to replace the inadequate choices faced by plaintiffs with a clear rule. The statute of limitations would be tolled during the pendency of the federal action and for 30 days after dismissal. The district court's interpretation here effectively eviscerates this protection and contradicts the very purpose of the statute. The clear and straightforward language of 28 U.S.C. 1367D provides, quote, "The period of limitations for any claim asserted under subsection A and for any other claim in the same action that is voluntarily dismissed at the same time or as or after the dismissal of the claim under subsection A shall be tolled while the claim is pending and for a period of 30 days after it is dismissed unless state law provides for a longer tolling period." So this provision was designed precisely for situations like the one we're facing here. In this case, the appellant, the appellee, and the federal court all did exactly what the statute contemplates. Appellant filed a motion for voluntary dismissal, and the court, the federal court, granted that motion for voluntary dismissal with no objection from the appellee. None of the appellant's claims were dismissed on 11th Amendment grounds, and there was no adjudication of the merits of the claim or any substantive ruling on appellee's potential 11th Amendment defenses prior to the voluntary dismissal. While appellants anticipate that appellees will argue that this case was dismissed on 11th Amendment grounds, it simply wasn't. The procedural posturing at the time it was dismissed, appellee's motion to have it dismissed in the federal case was still in its infancy. There hadn't been a response, and the federal court hadn't taken it up and considered it at all. The voluntary dismissal happened prior to any of that. So as a principal matter, Idaho courts have never adjudicated the interaction between 1367D and voluntary dismissals as it relates to claims against the state of Idaho. The district court's reliance on Ragour and Nowak in entering judgment against the appellants was misplaced because those cases are clearly distinguishable from the facts of this case. The Ragour decision cited by appellees did not prohibit the tolling provision from applying to voluntary dismissals. Rather, Ragour specifically held that the tolling did not apply when a claim is dismissed due to 11th Amendment sovereign immunity. There was a lot of issues in that case discussing federalism and sovereign immunity and when a state can be hailed into court. So that distinction, though, between the voluntary dismissal in this case and the involuntary dismissal in Ragour is very important, particularly when we look at the next case, which is Nowak. So in Nowak, the court held that the tolling under 1367D does not apply when the claims are dismissed due to sovereign immunity or for reasons I mentioned in the statute. And this goes back to Ragour because we're talking about very, very slim interpretation because of there are constitutional issues whenever a state is hailed into federal court. So this is crucial here. The language in Nowak was crucial here because the specific circumstance of Nowak was that the plaintiff entered a stipulated dismissal, which the court held was not something contemplated by 1367B. In this case, however, the appellant filed a motion for voluntary dismissal, which is the exact term of art used in the statute 1367D. And it is the specific mechanism that 1367D envisioned just under the plain language of that statute.
But I guess I'm going back a little bit in your argument. Do I understand the record correctly that Judge Nye, on August 9th of 2022, issued a memorandum decision and order dismissing the claims against at least the individual defendant, Kelly Meacham? Is that right?
Yes, he dismissed individual defendants for some procedural issues related to service. And this will come up later in my argument, but he didn't dismiss the claim outright. He just dismissed the defendant from the suit. And so it wasn't until later, I think it was October 3rd, if I get my dates right, when the voluntary dismissal was effectuated for all of the claims.
So you're saying that the August 9th, 2022 order, I mean, the language that I see is it says the claims against Kelly Meacham are dismissed without prejudice. That wasn't a dismissal?
I think because later, just jumping ahead of my argument, there's an issue of claims being dismissed versus defendants being dismissed in the particular language, and understand that Judge Nye used the word claim, but it's our position the claim, because the claim was brought against all the defendants, it was one claim, and that claim remained alive until October 3rd when it was voluntarily dismissed, even though some of the defendants had been dropped out of that claim.
We understand how a defendant can still be in a case if the defendant has no surviving claims. In what capacity are they in the case?
So I agree. The defendant is, that particular defendant is no longer in the case. But the claim still is, and that's important because the 1367D applies to claims, not to defendants in tolling statute of limitations. It's the same concept when we talk about res judicata, claim preclusion, or if you bring a claim against several defendants and that's adjudicated, you can't later bring the same claim against other defendants in the same case because the claim itself is what is being litigated. Hopefully that answers that. I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. As observed in Sanders v. the University of Idaho, voluntary dismissal is the very mechanism that 1367 is designed to protect. Quote, the Supreme Court decided nearly two decades ago that tolling under 28 U.S.C. 1367D was not available for claims dismissed on 11th Amendment immunity grounds. Alternatively, she could have voluntarily dismissed the IPPEA claim and refiled in state court instead of opposing it, its dismissal at summary judgment, and gained the benefit of 1367D's tolling provision, which, again, Sanders v. University of Idaho is a district court case, a federal district court case, but you have a federal judge holding exactly for, or opining exactly for, the mechanism that the appellants followed in this case, which again supports the appellant's position that the procedure that they followed in voluntarily dismissing the case, taking advantage of 1367D and moving the case into state court, was appropriate. And I want to highlight that the appellees had the opportunity to object to appellant's voluntary dismissal, but they didn't. Even though the voluntary dismissal was clearly telegraphed to invoke the protections of 1367D, in fact, they didn't just not object, they filed a notice of non-objection. So they weren't required to file a notice, and the federal court certainly never made that a condition. And while that's not a waiver per se, it's difficult to contemplate how this notice has any other effect than a waiver of an appellee's right to have the federal court adjudicate what was their then pending motion. So despite all of this, the district court concluded that the appellant's subsequent state complaint were time-barred in refusing to apply the tolling in 1367D. And the district court relied on speculation and inference, which was both unwarranted and legally irrelevant.
Mr. Hart, I need
yes.
to go back to your issue on claims, because if you look at the case, it's the Kim versus where they talk about a claim being dismissed triggers the relevant statute of limitation, even though the whole matter is dismissed. And so I understand you're saying that the claim is against all, but the defendant is dismissed. That defendant, the claims against that particular defendant are now done. So why doesn't the statute start as tolling once that claim is dismissed as to that particular defendant?
Well, I think that goes back to the difference between action and claim, and we're looking at Kim v. Dickinson. I think they're saying that the action continued, but the claims for certain defendants had ceased. And so when the claim as a whole had ceased, at that point the statute of limitations would have started up again. But in this case, we had five claims that were against all defendants. I don't think they had the same circumstances in Kim.
Isn't this why we let judges, whether it's in federal court or state court, dismiss certain parties so that they can be out of the case, get on with their lives, not worry about having to care about what's going on in the case anymore? You're suggesting that even though the judge has dismissed them as a party, they still somehow have some residual connection to the case, notwithstanding the dismissal.
I think that's ultimately the interaction 1367D has when the claim survives, even though defendants are dismissed. And that's a little facet in how that works.
I mean, I can see how there might be a witness to the case still, but they're not a party to the case any longer. They don't need to file anything. They have no legal requirements after that one, do they?
They wouldn't have any legal requirements under that case. And if that case wasn't dismissed at the federal level, it goes all the way through adjudication, they wouldn't have any recourse against them because they would have been dismissed. However, when that claim is voluntarily dismissed, later the statute of limitations was tolled. And so the case starts again in state court, which renews their obligation to defend themselves at that point. And I think it matters a little bit how it necessarily was dismissed, right? Because if it was dismissed because they were the wrong defendant or on some hard procedural ground, then even if the statute of limitations was told, they could never be rebrought into the case. But where this was a notice issue, that notice issue was cured in the second time around when it was filed in state court because it was served properly.
Assuming it was not time-barred.
Yes, assuming it was not time-barred, yeah. So going back to the district court's decision, I think the speculation that the district court relied upon was that, appellants saw the error of their ways and that they knew they were going to lose, and so they, and he equivocated that inference with actual dismissal under the 11th Amendment. And again, the statute's application does not depend on the court's interpretation, the district court's interpretation of the party's motivations. What it depends on is the plain language of the statute. Now, skipping ahead, but assuming for a second that the tolling provisions of 1367 doesn't apply to Meekum and the other individual defendants, that's where we would talk about Idaho Code 5234, because Idaho Code 234 tolls the statute of limitations whenever a injunction, or I can read that quote, when the commencement of the action is stayed by injunction or statutory prohibition, the time of the continuance of the injunction or prohibition is not part of the time limited for the commencement of the action. So in instance, under Idaho Code 5234, whenever there is a statutory prohibition or stay on filing an action, that time gets added to the end of the case. So
before we get too far down that road, let's talk about the structure of where this provision appears in the Idaho Code. 5234 is part of a title that sets forth statutes of limitation for all kinds of different actions. The Tort Claims Act, whenever you've got a claim against a criminal entity, deals with, it has its own statute of limitations in its own section of the Idaho Code. So why do we read 5234 in pari materia, or in other words, read it as part of a completely separate statute of limitations scheme in a separate title of the code? Why would we apply it?
So I think the reason why we would apply it is because it's a general tolling provision. It doesn't limit itself just to that chapter of the code. It just says whenever this action, which is the injunction or statutory prohibition, applies, then this code would apply. And there isn't a whole lot of case law on this point exactly, but there is some case law on another code within that section, which is the 5230 code, in the case of Doe v. Dirtshee, where the 5230 code was, for minors, it was applied to the 120-day filing requirement under 6906. So again, it was a statute under the general tolling statutes that was also applied to the Idaho Torts Code. In that case, it was specific to minors, but it was, again, an example of how a general tolling statute applies generally. Because if the general tolling statute didn't apply across the board, then it would essentially be reading it out of the rest of the codes by inference, which I think is a incorrect reading of the statute.
Well, except for that point, I mean, there are other statutory schemes, for example, the requirement that there be a pre-litigation screening process for all med-mal cases, you know, that has an express tolling provision. And then, you know, there are other instances where the legislature has done what you're asking us to do expressly in the statute itself.
Yes. And where there's an express tolling provision, I think the general tolling provision wouldn't apply. So the general tolling provision is just that. It's general whenever there's not another more specific provision that would push this back. And so when we're talking about the Idaho Tort Act, there isn't a specific provision that actually tolls the time. And so you have to fall back on the general provision because there's not something that supersedes it within that statute. And I think the Med-Mal statute is also a very good example of this because it provides the statute of limitations time, but then allows you extra time at the end of this if you don't file your notice and get your panel request in until the last days of your original statute. And I think functionally, statute 5234 works the same way in a general sense in this, because if you didn't file your notice for the Idaho state claims until, say, 30 days from your statute of limitations, without this general tolling statute, there's nothing in the Idaho Torts Claim that would save your claim. Because you can't file it before the 90 days, but your statute of limitations would expire before the 90 days. And so the risk that you run is you have this implied alternative statute of limitations if we don't have a tolling statute, which is, even though the code says 2 years under 9-11, if we can't toll it because of 5-234, it really means that the statute of limitations is 90 days before your 2 years. And I think that creates way too much confusion, which is why the legislature has decided to give these sort of statutes a general tolling rule. And so just to clarify that point, it's really the interaction between you can't file a case against the state of Idaho without first giving them notice, and then you can't file a case again against the state of Idaho under the Tort Claim Act unless they deny your claim that you filed against them.
What authority do you have for that? Because the Tort Claims Act requires that you file it, not that it be denied.
The Tort Claims Act under 910, pull that up here, says it gives permission for the plaintiff to file in court. It says, quote, if a claim is denied, a claimant may institute an action in the district court against the governmental entity or its employee in those circumstances where an action is permitted by this act.
I wonder if you're reading a word into that statute and says the other claim is denied, your argument would make more sense if the statute read only if a claim was denied. But it doesn't say that. It says if a claim was denied. Isn't there a distinction there?
There certainly, it would be more clear if the word only was there, yes. But I think, again, it would be wrong to read a statute in a way that renders it pointless. Because otherwise, what's the point of the 90-day limitation on filing a claim? If you could just send them notice, and then as soon as you send them notice, you could run right to court to file an action.
Has any court in Idaho ever ruled that it was improper to file a complaint the day after you submitted?
There were two cases that we cited in the brief that touched on it, but I don't know that we've ever actually, the Idaho courts have ever actually distinctly held that point.
Which two cases? Because the one that you cite, too, on page 6 of your opening, page 13, number 5, is the Curtis versus City of Ketchum case and then the Madison case. And what you quoted to us are the holdings of the district court. And what are the holdings of the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals?
So, yeah, in a sense, then it's not necessarily binding on this court to find that way, but it's certainly instructive for how district courts should be reading the interplay between these statutes. And with that, I think we'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court and Judge Simpson, thank you very much for the opportunity to appear here today in Rexburg, Idaho at BYU, Idaho. And I and my firm represent Mr. Kelly Meekum. He is a physician's assistant certified by the state of Idaho and also with national certification. And Mr. Meekum is actually present here in the court today. I have 12 minutes, now 11 and a half minutes. And my co-counsel, Mr. Brown, and I divided up our time 12 minutes for me to present my argument, 18 minutes. I am going to address principally 28 U.S. Code Section 1367 sub D and how it affects Mr. Meekum. This panel first focused its attention, I think very rightfully so, on how the U.S. District Judge ruled in this case on August 9th, 2022. And Judge Nye's ruling is in the record, from pages 109 of the record to page 123, he wrote a memorandum decision and order, and quoting from his order provision, it states in paragraph 11, the claims against Skip Green and then a number of the other, who I will refer to as the individual defendants that are individual state defendants, if you will. And then and Kelly Meekum are dismissed without prejudice. So the word claims is used in that very paragraph. So that is Judge Nye's order. And so the individual defendants, they're kind of capitalized I, individual D defendants, and then Mr. Meekum, are their claims are dismissed and dismissed without prejudice. And so there's no question from the record as to the disposition at that time of those claims. And so following along with the application of Section 1367, sub 28 U.S. Code, Section 1367, sub D, what that statutory provision does is it does toll the state claims relevant statutes of limitations. There's no question here that other than the question related to, which you were just hearing about, related to the Idaho Tort Claims Act. But 2 years is the statute of limitations, dating from the very unfortunate passing of the young Mr. Bray in this case. And so that the case in the U.S. District Court was filed 1 day before that 2 year period expired. It was filed on November 24th, 2021. So with the application of Section 1367 sub D, there was 1 day left plus the 30 days that are given in that section. So if you calculate that, that would take us to September 9th, 2022. There was not another case filed either in the U.S. District Court, because remember, the claim was dismissed without prejudice. It seems like Judge Nye would have entertained it again. I'm not trying to speculate, but he did dismiss it without prejudice. So it could have been refiled within that period of time. And, you know, these types of cases that relate to, you know, how does that time period run? They're pretty scarce. You know, the main U.S. Supreme Court cases that, of course, are cited by both sides in this, you know, really relate to issues of does, in the Justice Ginsburg case that she wrote, you know, does this actually create tolling, even though the word tolling is used? There were dissents in that case. There's another case written by Justice Scalia, related to whether or not a subordinate entity of a state, the state of South Carolina, could have sovereign immunity under this statute. And the answer was no, the state has it, not the county. Both of those cases are cited in our brief at some length. But I will certainly be happy to answer any questions about Jinks versus Richland County, which was the South Carolina case, and then the other case of Artis. But the main case that we have discovered, that was Artis versus District of Columbia, was the Justice Ginsburg case related to the actual tolling. And I want to talk about that Kim case that was decided in 2019 by the Nevada Supreme Court, because in our review of the relevant case law, that really is the case that is, I think, quite very much on all fours with this case to a great degree. That case, Kim versus Dickinson Wright, PLLC, 442 Pacific 3rd, 1070 from the Nevada Supreme Court in 2019, held that the dismissal of a claim starts the statute of limitations running with the additional 30-day period added. So that case was brought by two individuals, a Mr. Kim and a Mr. Hong, and the case involved multiple parties. It related to real property, and Kim and Hong had hired a Mr. Damas who was handling a real property dispute for them. But he failed to file a complaint to protect their interests, and the property was foreclosed. So this led to the hiring of a different law firm, the Gibson Lowry Law Firm. All these law firms, it gets a little complicated, but you know, we laid this out in our brief. I read the case, it's just complicated. But so Kim and Hong then filed a complaint regarding this foreclosure in the federal court. After they initially filed, this Gibson firm filing on their behalf, they decided to then add on a claim, a state claim, for legal malpractice against Mr. Damus because he had failed to, you know, in their view, he had committed legal malpractice by failing to file the case. So Damus filed a motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction in the federal court. That was granted to Mr. Damus in 2010. So the federal action, according to the text of the Nevada Supreme Court, the federal action continued, but Damus was out of it. So kind of like Mr. Meekum. Mr. Meekum, the claims were dismissed as to him. He's out. So Mr. Damus is out. More than 3 years after this, when the federal case was finally dismissed in 2015, so we're going from 2010 to 2015, Kim asked the successor firm, the Dickinson Wright firm, because they had merged in or merged the Gibson firm. He said, did you file an action against Damus? Whatever happened to my malpractice action? So then Kim files a malpractice action against Dickinson, which is the case that we're citing. That Nevada Supreme Court says, the statute's plain language, and I'm quoting from them now, distinguishes between the word claim and action in the phrase any other claim in the same action, 28 U.S. Code 1367 sub D. The 1367 sub D's language makes clear that it does not toll the relevant statute of limitations while the action is pending, but instead only tolls the relevant statute of limitations while the state law claim is pending. A federal court's dismissal of a state law claim rather than dismissal of the entire action therefore triggers the running of the relevant statute of limitations. So while not binding authority certainly on this court, it is a sister state Supreme Court in a very similar context interpreting that federal statute after. And in fact, they reversed the lower court in that case. Here we are asking you to affirm it. And I wanted to get back to a question that Justice Mahler asked, or an observation, perhaps more accurately. So in this particular instance, Mr. Meekum is an individual defendant. As I read to you from Judge Nye's decision, claims against him were dismissed. The District Court of the State of Idaho, Judge Mitchell Brown, agreed with my client's position that the claims against him were time barred under 1367 sub D. However, if we took the appellant's position, that case that was filed that remained, the remaining defendant was the state of Idaho, the Idaho Department of Juvenile Correction. As you would see in Judge Nye's decision, he did not dismiss them. They remained in the case. They were later dismissed in October of 2022. But let's posit that they hadn't been dismissed. Let's posit that. Let's say that for some reason that, and I don't want to trench on Mr. Brown, but let's posit that they hadn't been dismissed. And maybe we'll substitute instead of the, you know, a state entity, it's another, you know, a corporation, let's say, providing services at the juvenile correction facility. That case could have gone on for several years in the federal court. And so once that was finally decided against just that entity, then the 31 days, if we take the appellant's position, the 31 days would start to run and allow for the filing of that dismissed claim from the federal district court, which is certainly not, you know, what statutes of limitations or even tolling provisions are intended to get at.
Can you help me understand something procedurally on this before you run out of time?
Yes, yes.
As I understand the case involved the tragic death of a juvenile in a juvenile facility nearby here in St. Anthony.
Yes.
And later, allegations made about whether that was handled correctly on site, and then later he was taken to an emergency room here in Madison County. Is your client a necessary party to the claim against the Juvenile Correction Center, or did that have been pursued as a totally separate matter?
It could have been pursued separately. He, as I think Your Honor observed, he might be a witness potentially, but he's not a necessary party.
And does that make any difference if we're talking about a necessary party that gets dismissed on some procedural ground as opposed to a party upon which there are unique and distinct claims against? That isn't necessarily a necessary party.
You know, Your Honor, 28 U.S. Code 1367 sub D was really kind of subjected to a lot of criticism in the Justice Ginsburg artist decision versus District of Columbia. I think one of the unfortunate things is that it's a little bit difficult to figure out exactly how that melds with some of the other aspects of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, et cetera. I'm sorry that we didn't brief this. We would be happy to provide briefing if you would request that from us. But it would seem that 28 1367 sub D does not make a distinction between the type of claim. It doesn't make that distinction. So I would submit no. But again, we're happy to, you know, follow up if the court so orders.
Have you looked at the issue, though? It occurs to me that one wrinkle, and I'll speak from the state perspective because I understand that perspective much better than the federal procedural perspective. A dismissal of a party from a multi-party suit halfway through it is not final. That is to say, it's not an appealable order. At that point in time, the person is in limbo. The entity is in limbo for however long the case goes on. And they could, in fact, if there were an appeal after the case proceeded, they could be brought back into the action. And so I'm wondering if that August 9th, 2022 dismissal, was it final? Was it appealable? And if it wasn't, does that change this analysis under the statute?
I think what Your Honor is referencing, is very significant, certainly in terms of state law and finality. I think that, and there's been a lot of this court attempting, you know, to really make sense in that area, which is appreciated. But 1367 is extremely specific, and it's relating to that tolling.
Right. You know, I want to focus on dismissal. Mm-hmm. What is the effect of that dismissal in August of 2022? Is it a final appealable order?
All claims against my client were dismissed on that date, and it was styled as an order. It's not just an opinion. It is a memorandum and order in the record. And so as of that date, I would submit that that was final. That could have been appealed because it related to service. And so, the federal court would allow other attempts at service, which is, I think, why it was dismissed without prejudice. But I would submit it was final. All claims against all of those individual defendants and Mr. Meekum were dismissed as of that date and could have been appealed. You know, there were findings potentially that could have gone, you know, or to the Ninth Circuit potentially. So, thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice Bevin, members of the court. I think at the bottom of this case is the question of whether what's the point of having a statute of limitations? And if we have them, we should follow them. And we need to follow what the legislature says, both in terms of the statutes of limitations themselves, and also what they expressly say about when those statutes are subject to some sort of tolling. And so that's probably the key legal issue here in my mind. The key factual issue is what led to this result. The plaintiffs spend a lot of time in the first part of their opening brief talking about the horrible consequences of deciding this case against them because it puts plaintiffs in an untenable position where they have to file in state court, file in federal court, have simultaneous lawsuits going on, et cetera, et cetera. That's not true. The fact is, all they had to do was file their action in state court in a timely manner instead of filing it in state court nearly 3 years after the event in question. And you say, well, they've got a right to go to federal court. They've got a 1983 claim. They've got a right. But the way the 11th Amendment works is a federal court doesn't have jurisdiction because of the 11th Amendment for the most part when an individual sues a state. So my point there is that this case never should have been filed in federal court in the first place. And we spent a significant amount of time in federal court, you know, with the service issues. That's all in the record attached to my declaration. You can see Judge Nye's decision and how all of those things happened. But at the end of that whole process, what happens is all of the individual defendants are dismissed. And I agree with Ms. Silak that at that point, as a practical matter, it's final as to those people. And they shouldn't get drugged back in later on an untimely complaint in state court. The ultimate point here is that everything that you see in this case in terms of the factual and procedural things that occurred happened because of the choices the plaintiffs made and what I would at least suggest are dilatory tactics in how they went about their business in this case. And you see it time after time. You see a notice of tort claim that's filed shortly after the event in question, but then a lawsuit isn't filed until the day before the two-year anniversary, 15 months later or whatever it was. You see in the history that Judge Nye describes, in terms of the service issues in federal court, you see the details of how all of that played out. Instead of just serving the defendants and getting on with it, months were spent with the plaintiffs making multiple attempts to try to do the service in the right way. They didn't even get summonses issued for the individual defendants until the federal time had run out. You see the same thing in the last minute sort of King's X maneuver to voluntarily dismiss the case against IDJC after getting two extensions to respond to our motion to dismiss the federal case on 11th Amendment grounds. On the very last day, that they had to respond to the motion that we made to dismiss after two extensions. They file out of the blue, they just file a motion for voluntary dismissal.
So counsel, I hear you suggesting that there was some tactical advantage to doing it this way. I'll make sure I understand what you're getting at there.
Well,
what is the tactical advantage of doing a voluntary dismissal?
I don't think it's a tactical advantage situation, Your Honor. I think it's just dilatory tactics. And I think it leads to the whole mess that's before this court at this point. And so that's why we're here.
So if the intent was to be dilatory, if the intent was to drag this on, what would be the incentive then to voluntarily dismiss? So the case technically stayed alive until then.
Because they read the brief that we filed to dismiss on 11th Amendment grounds. And in that brief, if you take a look at it, it's in the record. We're not talking about some new law. This 11th Amendment jurisprudence in general has been around forever.
So I'm not being facetious here, but you filed a brief that was so devastating, they realized they couldn't win, so they voluntarily dismissed. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, my own belief, Your Honor, is that they ran across Judge Windmill's decision that, as Judge Brown said in his decision, as a matter of dicta, Judge Windmill in another case had said, well, why didn't you just voluntarily dismiss this federal case and go to state court?
So your point that the dismissal was dilatory, I get that asking for the postponements was dilatory, but dismissing the case voluntarily when confronted with overwhelming legal authority sounds prudent and doesn't sound dilatory. It sounds like they did what they should have done.
And so if that's the case, Your Honor, why did they wait 31 days after that to file why didn't they wait 31 days, or why did they wait 31 days to file their state court action? Everything they did in this case was done at the last minute, was done without thinking through the issues.
I agree with you. The question you just asked is really probably the most important unanswered question in this case, but that has nothing to do with the applicability of 1367.
True, and I'm happy to address that. I think that when you boil it down, the 11th Amendment says federal courts, for the most part, don't have jurisdiction against states. That's all outlined fairly extensively in our brief in federal court. The Ragour case, essentially what happened procedurally is there had been that dismissal on federal, on 11th Amendment grounds. In the Doe case, or excuse me, the NOAC case, this court said that it doesn't have to be a dismissal on 11th Amendment grounds in order for 1367 to not apply. And so you take those two together, you combine those with the what happened in this case, and the end result is that it would be a charade, as the district court said, to allow the plaintiffs here to take advantage of Section 1367 tolling to delay this case against the state.
Well,
I understand what Judge Brennan said and what he said, but wasn't he speculating about the motives of the plaintiffs in that case? And if that's the case, how do we affirm him?
Well, I don't think you're talking about the part of his decision where he talked about his conjecture. Yeah, I don't think his conjecture is necessary to the legal effect of what's gone on here. I mean, what happened was the voluntary dismissal in this case in the face of overwhelming 11th Amendment authority was a King's X move.
Well, it might have been, but the question, though, is by making that finding and dismissing on those grounds, doesn't he disregard the language of the statute where it says voluntarily dismissed?
Yes. Apologize, counsel. The clock is frozen at 2:49 for you. We'll be in recess for a brief moment to test our recording. Very well. We will recess into the voting room for a few minutes.
All right, please.
Good to go. Thank you, then, Mr. Brown. Judge Simpson, I'm trying to hearken back to the question just before that happened.
Yeah, the question, if I can remember correctly, was doesn't Judge Brown disregard the actual statutory language when there's a voluntary dismissal? And the statute on the furniture is 1567.
Well, if that's true, then the, I mean, what happened in this case was they filed out of the blue on the last day that they had to respond to our 11th Amendment motion, a voluntary dismissal. I mean, I was expecting a brief.
So why not object to it and force a hearing on your motion?
Why not object to it? I guess I have not been in a circumstance where the plaintiff offers to voluntarily dismiss their case and the defense objects and says, no, we want to keep going.
But if we're talking about the brief that you submitted, they got scared and said, hey, we need to get rid of this case so we can refile. If you had a decision on the objection, then the tolling statute wouldn't have applied to you if the court had granted your motion.
I suppose that's true, but for example, Your Honor, I wasn't aware of Ragor at that moment. We were just delighted that the case was going to be dismissed, and the fact is, we didn't know that it was going to be refiled in state court because the statute of limitations had long since run at that point, in our view. So, I guess that's kind of the way I see that. So the long and the short of it is if the stipulated dismissal in NOAC did not trigger 1367 for 11th Amendment reasons, then it seems like this is the functional equivalent of that.
Did NOAC, they were looking at the language of the statute, and they said nowhere does it say stipulated dismissals, but the statute does say voluntary.
I think in the circumstances of this case, it is not a distinction because what happened here was they filed their motion for or their voluntary dismissal. We filed a notice of non-opposition. To me, that's the functional equivalent of a stipulated dismissal, just like the NOAC case.
Thank you, sir. I believe your time has expired. Is that right?
I'm sorry, am I out of time?
I believe you are, yes.
I'll just say we'll submit the rest of our argument per the brief. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
I'd like to start by revisiting this issue of claims, actions, defendants.
Again, if you can speak up, sir.
Sorry. When we look at the Kim case that was cited, I think it's important to read the facts and procedural history there, because under the facts, it looks like Kim filed a complaint against the property developers, against the real estate defendants there, four claims related to that botched deal or that her attorney had not preserved. And then her attorney, she later amended her claim to include her attorney. And so the claims against the real estate, the malpractice claims against the attorney, while they may have been joined in the same suit, they were very distinct claims. And so when the claims against the attorney for malpractice were dismissed, they weren't dependent on any of the other, they weren't commingled with any other defendants. And so they really were separable. And that really wasn't the kind of instance that 1367D was intended to prevent. 1367D, again, when we talk about the what we've termed, you know, the parade of horribles here, horrible choices of having to maintain actions in both state and federal court, and potentially trying to ask the state court to stay the state claims until the federal claims can be administered. That's kind of exactly what would have happened here. If the claims as to the individual defendants would have had to been filed earlier, then we would have had to file claims against those defendants in state court and then ask within the 30 days of that August 1st and then ask that court to stay those until we could run the exact same claims under the exact same facts in federal court all the way down the line. And I think going back a little bit to this this issue of necessary parties res judicata. If it's where it was the same claim, we have multiple defendants on the same claim. If that claim had gone all the way through adjudication and had been adjudicated one way or another, had we been successful or unsuccessful, we could not have then re-raised the claim against the other defendants because that claim would have been decided and would have been prevented from re-bringing those same claims against the defendants. And so, again, they're not actively in the case once they've been dismissed from it, but that doesn't mean that the claim against them has been dismissed and is no longer live, which is why, pursuant to 1367D, when the claim was dismissed in October, that's when the time, the 30 days plus the one day or the 90 days as well, under the Idaho tort statute would have applied at that point.
So let me take you back a couple clicks there. You said even though the defendants wouldn't be in the case, the claims still survive? The claims against them still survive in the federal case? Is that what you meant to say?
I meant to say the claim as a whole, because it's one claim against several defendants, and if some of those defendants leave, the claim is still live.
Okay, thank you.
So, unless there's other questions on those issues, I think I'll end with this issue of attorney's fees. And it's relatively straightforward. The remaining issues, if the appellants are successful on any of the arguments we've raised, then the claims were clearly not frivolous. They're based on established legal principles, and they're supported by case law and statutes. And even if we're not successful, I think it's a step too far to say that the claims and arguments that we've raised were meritless. They weren't grounded in any sort of legal theory or had a reasonable basis in law and precedent. A claim is not frivolous simply because it's unsuccessful. It must lack legal foundation, which is not the case here, especially where we have a federal judge and district court who outlined the exact procedure that we followed to get the claims from the federal court to the state court. And with that, I concede the rest of my time and rely on the briefing, submit on the briefing.
Before you sit down,
yeah.
Could you address the attorney's fee issue? Why was there abuse of discretion in the award of attorney's fees there?
The award of attorney's fees was due to Judge Brown's decision that the filing, the plaintiff's claims that 1367D and the other statute, Idaho tort statute, didn't apply to the case at hand. They didn't actually toll, and there was no reasonable legal basis to believe that they would toll that time. And therefore, they were frivolous, and the state was entitled to fees. But I think, again, where we have the plain language of the statute says that a voluntary dismissal acts to trigger the protections of the statute, and you have a federal court specifically outlining in another case where a defendant was faced with a similar dilemma, outlining things that they could have done, which is exactly what we did do, I think there's a reasonable legal basis to the actions that we took, and therefore they're not frivolous because there was a basis to engage in those. Hopefully that answers your question. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Senator is now under advisement in the court. We're under decision accordingly. We'll be in brief recess before we come back, because I understand we have a period of time for question and answer here in the room.